going deep within, I want you to feel that the very life that is within your body is the life that comes from God, from the divine source. And to feel your body not so much as a physical body, but to feel it as a light body, body filled with life energy, pure, whole, and complete from the divine source. In the Vedas, it says that the breath of God is the breath behind your own breath. And to feel that as you breathe in, it is God who is breathing through you. It is God's breath that is coming into your body. And that as you exhale, you are exhaling into God. A giving and a receiving. Also to feel that your body is not your circumference. Rather, spirit expands beyond this physical body. And a circumference never. Simply the attunement of your mind, you may reach out into all space. And to feel that you have absolutely no true definitions. That the entire universe can be contained within your own spine. Or that you can identify with the smallest of molecules, atoms, electrons. That you are in truth spirit, and spirit has become you. Now you are the truth from the very foundations of this creation. It was, and it is, and it ever shall be. And you are that, and that has become you. You are now merged in that consciousness, established in it. I'd like to read something that I wrote for the New Year's, Standing at a Crossroads. As we close out 2013 and welcome in 2014, we stand at a crossroads. The world offers much in technology, conveniences, entertainment, and distractions. From a spiritual standpoint, all of this is worthless and an obstruction. To make true spiritual progress, the world needs to be set aside. In the pursuit of a calm equanimity, the twin stimulants of tamasic and rajasic, the depressive and activating qualities, are known to be the impediments to attaining conscious union with the divine. One must surmount the qualities of this age to go beyond the things of the body to ascend to things of the spirit. Worldly nature manifests in the news and leads based on if it bleeds, it leads. And in advertising, the watchwords are sex sells. These are more than truisms. You can see it in action on a daily basis. When someone is looked up to as a hero today, there is a concerted effort to find some scandal to take him or her down. The world is stood on its head. If someone stands for a clear values, they are seen as villains. And if someone spits in the eye of core values, they are held up as heroes. There is even less popular culture support for Dharma and spiritual living today than any previous time. Even as in times past, individuals have risen above the environment in which they were born, so we too may strive to go beyond the values and ideals presented to us by the world. To be a pioneer is not easy, as you have no support and oftentimes opposition from those around you. To come together in singing God's name, to support each other in living a life of purity and integrity, and to feel the joy of meeting kindred spirits is the meaning of satsang, to associate in the name of the eternal self. The origin of the term religion is associated with the idea of coming together or connecting with God or with a group of lovers of God. We can draw spiritual strength when we come together for a higher purpose and feel the uplifting vibrations of such occasions. So come together often and find spiritual strength with kindred spirits. Enjoy satsang wherever you can. We live in a time when even well-known spiritual leaders have fallen far short of the spiritual ideals they teach. When we stand for truth and the realization of the supreme reality, we do not need to be afraid of facts. And when someone has fallen short of lofty goal, that may be a fact, but it is also not the sum total of the individual. When a spiritual head or adherent has acted out of desire nature or fear, and he or she makes a full turnabout and gets back on track, then we can see that one in the full context of their journey to God. If there is no contrition on that one's part, if there is no recognition of the harm done, then that is another matter, for there is no indication that anything has been learned or that the individual is once again pointed toward the light. Each of us stands at a crossroads of whether to go with the tendency of the world or to tear down what is good, or to take the inward path toward upward evolution. It is a decision we must make daily in recognizing that the world in general does not support the inner path. We must make a concerted effort to break the trance the world induces in individuals and en masse. Deep and sincere practice of meditation and God remembrance is the antidote to worldly influence. When you feel drawn to the peace and bliss of God, you find the world loses its allure. Just as when the body has cleared of an addictive substance, then even the thought of having that substance no longer has a hold on the individual. Even so, the devotee feeling the active joy of God does not yearn for the pleasures of the world. It takes time and practice to clear the body system of attraction of the five senses and to immerse the little self into God alone. However, living in the freedom and bliss of God makes whatever little effort expended in sadhana seem insignificant to what is given in return. Review 2013 with an eye for learning. What went right and why? And if things have gone wrong, then review what happened and why. Let us enter into 2014 with redoubled effort for realizing God. Double your meditation time. Seek to double the amount of time you are chanting God, and double your reliance upon God alone for your comfort, joy, peace, and guidance. May you be blessed in your sincere practice of God remembrance and service to Him in all forms. It is a new year, a new beginning, and you stand at a crossroads that, given the right choices, can take you far in your journey to your complete realization of the infinite. Review what went right and why. Oftentimes we take for granted the things we have done well, as if there is nothing to learn from that experience. Take some time and review the things that have been positive in your year. What decisions did you make to create those positive outcomes? What can you do to build upon those positive decisions to create even better outcomes? Build a strong self-image according to those clear decisions and feel the strength it brings to you. What went wrong and why? Many times we fall into self-loathing, wanting to hide from poor decisions or enter into self-pity. Instead, take some time to view your decision-making from a learning perspective, wanting to understand why you made certain decisions. If possible, do what you can to make restitution or repair a bad decision. Trace the steps to making a poor decision and find key moments of false logic or poor responses driven by emotions or desire nature. Recreate those key moments and see yourself making a wise decision. See it all the way through and experience how it feels. Then let the feeling reverberate all the way down to this moment as if that is exactly what you did. Let it change you down to the molecular level. Build a strong self-image for the present and for the future based on clear, positive decisions if you should find yourself faced with similar situation. See yourself, your God self, fully manifest and guiding you, protecting you, and ever present in your journey to self-realization. Happy New Year for 2014 with blessings from God and Gurus. And so I enacted the things that I talked about here, and I thought I would read down to you my list. From 2013, things done well. Deepening God awareness, following His will, serving Him in all forms, the Cross and Lotus Journal, the blog postings, and by the way, this letter was listed in yogashariadavid.com that you can read there. Things to improve, organizing, simplifying, expanding the website, mother's books and work, and health. Manifest in 2014, radiate God's light, serve God in all, deepen God consciousness, organize and simplify, website expansion, mother's books and work, and health. And so then I went into a more detailed plan of how to enact all of that. It is very interesting when people think about will. We seem to get mixed messages in a sense. Master is a great proponent of developing a strong will. Mother was as well. Mother and Papa also spoke often and deeply about surrender to God's will. And people oftentimes come with questions about will. What does it mean to surrender to God's will? Should I be developing my own strong will? Or should I be surrendering myself to God's will? And this is a wonderful and a deep subject, but I came up with four different aspects of how people live their lives. So God, planning, and will evolution. And the first stage is unconscious living. In that unconscious living, an individual does not necessarily reflect on life's goals or purpose, generally takes life as it comes, reacting to situations but not being proactive. It's focused on the world of the five senses and living in the moment. These individuals do not really think about why they came onto this world or what their life should really be all about. They follow the things that they are told as they grow up. They will feel themselves drawn to anybody who has a powerful will on their own. And through that, they just simply, you can say in a way blindly, their lives are led through this world. And as a result of that, whatever the strongest wind is blowing is what they will take. If you get into a crowd and something takes over that crowd, some kind of panic or some kind of hysteria, individuals will respond to that, and suddenly you'll see the herd mentality take over and everybody is in a panic. There's a stampede. Sometimes this happens within large stadiums where there's a game, people are excited, and suddenly there is a kind of literal stampede and people are literally trampled to death. People are not acting out of individual will, but out of group will. And sometimes because just the general will of the populace believes in a certain thing, that individual goes along with it. And they don't think deeply on these things. They just simply are living their lives. And so having an unconscious will, unconscious living, is the first stage. The second stage comes then, you might call it a semi-conscious, self-directed living. And having definite goals for material gain and profit, that individual feels enabled in the world to set out and gain goals. They may have ideas to better humanity, but it's primarily focused on helping family and community in a material way, on the horizontal plane. They don't think going beyond this material plane. They've expanded somewhat in there. They become semi-conscious. And they're now still not thinking of themselves as an individual soul and what they've come to attain. But they are thinking about their families. They are thinking about perhaps the larger community. They're primarily materially based. And so they're thinking about wealth. They're thinking about comfort and how to gain that for themselves and for other people. They feel far more enabled than the individual who's living in unconscious state. They see themselves now as more powerful, as more able and enabled to be able to achieve their goals in this world. And so they've awakened to that extent. If they enter into the next stage, they can be conscious living. And in conscious living, that individual has awakened to the higher nature in life, with a focus on life's real values and goals, making a conscious effort to meet those goals, to awaken the higher centers in the spine and the brain. Service is focused on the spiritual nature as well as the material nature of the world. So this individual is where many devotees and sadhakas find themselves. They are awakening to a higher nature within themselves. And they feel that beginning to occur. They feel the spine and the brain starting to wake up, so to speak. They're aware now of the higher centers and focused on gaining access to those higher centers. They're not yet living completely out of those centers, but they're aware of them. And they try to respond to them. Now, for the first time, surrender really starts to make sense. For somebody who is in a semi-conscious state of willfulness, you might say, or living, if they hear about surrender, they think of somebody who's unconsciously living. Well, you might as well just give yourself over to the whims of the world. Wherever the wind is blowing, that's the direction that you'll go. Whatever other people think, that's what you'll want to do. And that's what surrender is seen as, but that's not it. When you become conscious in your living, you're now able to perceive that there are higher values. And at first you take the laws of Moses, the laws of Manu, the lawgiver in India, if that's where you grow up. And there you see that there are higher ways to live. If you are a modern day Christian, you might be looking to Jesus and the principles and the values that he laid out, and you try to consciously ascribe yourself to those. As you learn a more harmonious, attuned kind of living with that, then you consciously feel that it is Jesus or one of the great masters who is inspiring you, and you feel the life energy, you feel the upliftment and consciousness, and now you're being guided not by some law, but you're being guided by an interior spirit that has become awakened within you. And when you know what the right thing is to do, you surrender yourself to that. And so that is living consciously in this world. And it's really when we first put our feet on the spiritual path. There are many people who attend churches. They think of themselves as being spiritual, but they have not really awakened to this interior spirit as of yet. They are still living by the law only. And so this is a great awakening when this happens, and sometimes it just happens occasionally, here and there. You get an inspiration, and you know that when that intelligence, when that guidance, when that upliftment comes, it takes you outside of yourself. It comes from somewhere beyond you. It's more powerful, it's more pure, it's more perfect than anything you could have imagined on your own. And through this conscious living, you learn to attune yourself to the higher consciousness. And through that, you are purified even more. And so it happens hand in glove, that as you surrender to this and you attune yourself to this higher consciousness, you are more purified. The more purified you become, the more you're able to listen and hear and feel that interior voice within you. This is a wonderful time in the life of a sadhaka. And gradually, you are lifted up. And you more and more begin to live in the fourth stage, and that is superconscious living. In superconscious living, you are now in tune with and alive to the highest spiritual consciousness within you. God has awakened himself within you, and you are consciously living according to his dictates and his direction, his power, his thought. Everything is a part of that superconscious or God-conscious aspect that is now manifesting through you. Now you live as a witness what formerly was the ego and was acting in a field of separation now lives in total submission and surrender. Now surrender makes total sense to you because you are attuning yourself and feeling yourself guided and lived through by this divine consciousness. This is a completely different way to live in this world. Now, by no means means that you are living according to the whims of this world, you see. That would be taking you all the way down to the first level or the unconscious living. You are living according to divine consciousness, and in that divine consciousness, you are more, you can say, more of a slave, as Papa would say it. That he was Ram Das, Das meaning slave, Ram meaning God. He was the slave to God. But through that slavery, through that complete and total surrender, you become totally free. Because you realized what a burden it was on you for the ego to feel separated and alone and trying to make all the decisions around its life, and how that just add a burden on top of burden. You see people who have attained a certain status in this world, whether it is through wealth or accomplishments or through fame. And as a result of that, they feel the burden of the world. They feel the pressure of the world being put upon them. When you live in the superconscious mind, you cast all of that burden onto God. And you feel through your inner attunement that you have earned, that God is now manifesting and living through you. So whether you're living consciously, or you're living superconsciously, or some combination of those two, because there's no strict boundaries between any of these. We can move back and forth between these, and at one time, we can have this superconscious inspiration, and then suddenly we are down into unconscious living because we are drawn into the realm of the senses. And this is a test that comes to us. Sometimes people are in very high states of consciousness and they are tempted. They are brought down to the very lowest level of consciousness. And you think, how can that be? They're living so much a part of God consciousness. But this is the nature of our spiritual path, and suddenly an obsession can take. Perhaps you have a sexual obsession, or an obsession for money, or some material, or for fame. And you see this within certain spiritual leaders. In the beginning, they start out with very pure purpose. And then that gets taken away. It gets taken into the world. It gets taken into the world of sex, and of money, and power, and position. And they lose what they had before. And it's extremely painful as this happens, as you're swept away downriver, and you realize at some point that you have lost it all spiritually. Now, some of these may be regarded as great spiritual beings by the world because they have attained a certain notoriety. But in truth, they have lost everything in God. Better far is to remain in the background if that is the only two choices. It takes a great soul to be able to enter into the world stage. Master came into this world, and he came, as Lari Mahasaya said, as a great engine of God, taking many, many souls to him. Now, to be able to enter into this world, to be able to enter into fame, to be able to have money and resources and everything at your fingertips and not be swept away into the world takes a great soul indeed. It takes a great purity of intention. And it can either lift you all the way into God consciousness, or it can sweep you completely into ego consciousness. Now, each person's life is outlined for them from the very beginning. Jesus knew what he would go through from the beginning of his life. And he knew the various steps. And within that, he knew that everything ultimately would be taken away from him. There is a time when greater fame came to him as he entered into Jerusalem. And all the people were crying out, Hosanna to God. And it disturbed other people because they saw it as man worship. And what was not yet introduced into the world, what Jesus came to introduce into the Western world in particular, in India and China and other places, they already knew it, at least in part. But it was a new notion that God could be man and man could become God. That is, could lift up and purify the consciousness to the extent where it is only God consciousness that was being made manifest within the individual. Now, down through time, through the Kali Yuga, this was taken to be only one individual 2,000 years ago. But the truth is, and what the truth that Jesus came to teach, is that it is the truth of every individual. And in no place did he say that he was the only one. This is an interpretation that has been put upon it since that time. To all them who received him gave he power to become sons of God. This is so critically important in understanding the true nature and the teachings of Jesus and his life. Now, the fact that people are able to accept it about one individual opens the door, you might say, even just a peek, and enters into the consciousness of humanity. And as people are able to accept that even about one individual, vicariously, they are also able to accept it about themselves. Now, if an individual is living semi-consciously, or even consciously, and say, I am God, I am He, it's coming from the ego standpoint still. It's not until you enter into super consciousness that those words can be said in all truth. Now, we have it in our prayer from Mother, and it is said as an affirmation. And the affirmation comes so that we might come into that state of realization. Once you begin to accept the notion, the idea that the possibility is there, you open that doorway within yourself. First, it has been opened to humanity. Now it has been opened within yourself. And as a result of being entered into, you now can hold yourself in that light, that you are God in human form. Now, if you say this from an ego standpoint, it won't be the truth. But if you say it as an affirmation, if you see it as a way of reaching out within your own mind for the truth of it, to find the truth of it, then it is helpful. So we must distinguish between these various states. Are we living consciously, which I hope that we all are, and moving into superconscious living, which is our destiny, which is where we're headed for. And so when you have that as your goal and your ideal, then you can open yourself that God is constantly speaking to you. He is the breath of your own breath. He is the thought of your own thought. He is the life of your own life. So when you feel yourself breathing, feel yourself that God is breathing in through your nostrils, in through your mouth. When you breathe out, feel that you're breathing into God's own breath. It is that close, it is that intimate. When you are thinking, it is God's power and intelligence that is flowing through your own mind. And when you connect your thoughts to God thoughts in that way, you open that door so that God thoughts can actually be flowing through your mind. Now, if you just say it from an ego standpoint, well, whatever I think is what God is thinking, you're in trouble. Because that's not the way that it is. But when you have the actual experience, the superconscious experience of God flowing through your own mind, then that becomes reality. When God is the life behind your own life, the life of your own life, that is flowing through your body. If you say it just on a human standpoint, you're just saying it from the five senses point of view. But when you feel that pure pranic force, that life force, flowing through you and activating all your body cells, and that it expands beyond your own physical body. First, it goes out to the auric field around you, that electromagnetic field that's all around you. It's a life force energy field. And it's about arm's length, and it goes all around you. And you may feel that activating force going out, and you feel it as a scintillating, vibratory life force that surrounds you. And when you see it with the ajna, with this point between the eyebrows, you see it as a beautiful golden light that is all around you. This is your protection. This is your guide. This is your life force, the pure life force. Lari Mahasya talked about life force prana with a small p and a capital P. And as a small p, it's the life force that's simply flowing through your own body. If you lift a hand, if you speak, if you have vision, you have this pranic life force in operation, but it's done largely in an unconscious way. But when you feel it as a purity, as a higher vibration that is coming through you, you're tuning in to the highest pranic life force, the divine life. And that divine life is now activating you, thinking through you, speaking through you, acting through you in every way. And now you're aware that it is God who is animating you and doing everything through you. This is superconscious living, and it is the highest form of living. It is when God and man have merged and become as one, so that Jesus say, I and my Father are one. And he can do that in a full state of conscious knowing. This is a wonderful, wonderful state to come to. And it is our evolutionary goal. It's the evolutionary goal of absolutely everyone who lives in this world. But we are the ones who are consciously seeking out to live in that state of consciousness, to not be unconscious living or even semi-conscious living, not just conscious living, trying to tune ourselves to the higher states of life, although that's an important stage. But we want to come into that full superconscious state in which these truths and these realities become our own. Now, when we come together as a group, that power is activated and it helps to quicken us. We both bring the power of God within us. As each one of you attunes yourself to that higher consciousness, it naturally radiates out from you and it influences the world all around you. When we do that as a group, that power begins to expand out. And it is a power that is so great. Not because you are great from an ego standpoint, but because God within you is so great, that power, that intelligence, that uplifting power can go out all over this world. You don't know all the effects that you have as you attune yourself to that highest intelligence and power. So this is a tremendous thing to come into the superconscious state, to learn how to enter it consciously and at will. Now, one time somebody offered to take a picture of Master, and he said, just one moment. And he instantly entered into that superconscious state of nirvikalpa samadhi. But there is a higher state, and Mother speculated that perhaps he didn't enter it until the very end of his lifetime. But when he did, then he merged into that divine consciousness so that there was no going in or out. That was a state that Mother finally attained in the early 1970s. I think by 1970, she never said, gave a date for it. But she started into those experiences in 1954. She said that they went for a total of 16 years. And that takes us to 1970, so sometime in the year 1970. She entered into that full state of Sahaja Samadhi. And at that point, as Mother talked about, she went over the top. There was no more going down into any other consciousness. God was fully activated and manifesting in her and through her at all times and places. This is what a great, tremendous spiritual master Mother was. This is a rarity in life. Even amongst great spiritual masters, Master himself said that of all those that he spoke about in the autobiography of a yogi, of all the saints that he met, there were two besides Sri Yukteswar that he knew of. One was Ram Gopal Mazumdar, great disciple of Vari Mahasya, and the other was Swami Pranabananda, another great disciple of Vari Mahasya, and of course Vari Mahasya and Babaji. But of all the great saints, he thought these were the ones who had attained it all. Ram Gopal Mazumdar was an individual of such great humility, and when Master asked him whether he would give him an experience in samadhi bliss, he doubted his own worthiness in being able to grant such a thing. And Master said, for so many years you meditated 18 hours a day. And then you meditated for so many years, 20 hours a day, and now you're 24 hours a day awake in God. And you doubt whether you are worthy to give me that experience? What about us mere mortals? What is to happen to us? And Ram Gopal Mazumdar said, don't hitch yourself to a near star that doesn't take you that far. But hitch yourself to the ultimate star. When God is infinite, do not think that you can hold the everythingness of God in such a thing as a single lifetime. Now, this is not to discourage us or to make us feel that we can never attain anything. It is simply to say that as long as you have any sense of individuality, you will always be an aspirant for God. You will always be expanding and learning more about God. And it is good. It is wonderful. Master one time was talking about attaining heaven, and he says, thinking about heaven and being an angel strumming harps and sitting on pink clouds, he thought, my God, how boring. What a limited thought. Now, one time, God gave me a vision of what it meant to be an angel at the foot of the throne of God and singing these songs. And the songs were bliss. And the songs that were coming out were all variations of bliss that was manifesting through these great beings as divine, harmonious vibration of song. And when you think about it as all the different variations of God's bliss manifesting through you, how enraptured you can feel, how uplifted, how perfect you feel at the foot of God in this way. Now, you don't have to go anywhere to be at the foot of God or at the throne of God. You can be right where you're at in a physical body, right here, right now. And you can be at the foot of God. You can be at the throne of God. You can feel that powerful vibration of bliss and upliftment and joy passing through you even now and going out from you to all this world is a blessing. You see how tremendous this is. And God created everything that is, so that if God needs you to perform some service on any level at all, from a material level to a mental level to a spiritual level, He can do it all. And He can easily commune through you and meet the needs of this world. You see what a powerful instrument of God you can be when you get out of the way and God manifests fully. The door is now fully open and you are manifesting as Him. I thought I would read to you some. We have Master's birthday and The Flawless Mirror by Kamala, who is a wonderful, great disciple of Master's. And she wrote this, The Flawless Mirror, and this is the foreword. Introspection, this is a quote from Master. Introspection is a wonderful mirror, but greater than that is to see your image in the flawless mirror of a wise man's mind. Association with my guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, over a period of 27 years during long and shorter intervals, in various locations and under different circumstances, is recorded here. Knowing the hunger of devotees for words about their preceptor, I have been asked so often, tell us about your days with Master. This is what I have endeavored to do. These pages include only that which touches directly upon my own discipleship and privileged hours with Him. It is possible that some passage or pictured scene will give insight into the eternal quality of Guru's relationship with the disciple. May this glimpse bless all who have his life has been blessed. There are crossroads in life which change the entire direction of travel. This was the hour of seeing my Guru. His precepts were highlight my journey upon a way that led heart and thoughts Godward. On the evening of January 13th, 1923, eventful date, 25, the Philharmonic Auditorium in Los Angeles was full to 3,000 capacity. The lines of people had queued around the building for great distances, waiting for the doors to open by 7 p.m. There was no more seating space for the hundreds who were still there. This was repeated each evening for many weeks. All had gathered to hear a certain emissary from India, from that land where sages had been nurtured. We were to know one of her most illumined. Swami Yogananda came upon the platform, his orange robe identifying him with an ancient order of renunciants. My spontaneous first impression was youthfully expressed in my diary. His smile is like a sunshine of a soul. It was joyous and conveyed a warmth that seemed to envelop everyone. How did I happen to be present? My mother saw billboards with his picture. Her interest was based on respect for the teachings of India, and she was seeking truth. I went with her and attended all of his lectures and series of beginning, advanced, and super advanced classes, which were filled with hundreds of enthusiastic students. In response to a request for volunteers, I served as an usher at the classes and lectures. Was I seeking? Not knowingly, but when I saw him, I thought, now I have found one who can answer any question I may have want to ask. School study brought forth academic answers, but they lacked a depth, a dimension I sense should be there. In church, I had received Christian teachings without a Rosetta Stone to translate them into realization. In Swami Yogananda, I found this wisdom. Paramahansaji gave specific methods of meditation. These enabled one to know how to delve within and follow the soul's pathway to the infinite. The few simple yogic techniques which he presented were essentially direct. They guided one without bypaths. Swami's lectures were preceded by organ playing, and the song of India often prefaced his appearance. Before his talks, he would read a poem, sometimes from his book, Songs of the Soul. His powerful declaration proclaiming the soul's continuing survival through eons of time is imprinted in my memory. He had a fund of enthralling and unforgettable stories, each conveying a spiritual precept. Many were garnered from his own experiences, some he had brought from India. One night he mentioned that in his childhood he had been extremely thin, and his present weight had come as a blessing from a healing from his guru. He is well aware that saintliness in the Western world is usually associated with thinness, even to the point of emaciation. With his keen enjoyment of humor, he explained that in India it is desirable to be pleasingly plump, because a thin teacher is a walking advertisement of a scarcity of pupils. At another evening, someone asked about his age. Spontaneous guesses ranged from 16 years to several hundred. But he replied with a smile, "I never tell my age." This left the question still open to speculation. No one then fully gauged that he did not measure life wholly by his brief residence in the body, for spirit is ageless. He welcomed everyone, after one lecture, to come and touch his arm, which he caused to be vibrant with energy in the manner of an electric power machine. This was a recharging of the body through will and life force, a beneficial way of exercise he taught in his classes. There were several physicians taking his courses. On one occasion, he asked if any doctor was present who would like to observe control of heartbeat. They were very interested and went up, with one on each side of him, touched his pulse at each wrist. They reported different counts at the left and the right. Then he caused all pulse to cease entirely, as well as breath. They could detect neither. One night, Swami invited all the men of the Los Angeles police force who were present at the doors of the auditorium to come forward to see if several would be able to push him off balance or to move him from the place he stood. A number of them responded and were surprised to find that their greater weight was of no avail in their efforts to dislodge him. I was to learn that such demonstrations were rarely given by him, for he sought to bring others to God through love for the Heavenly Father and not by the displays of phenomenal powers. On the first evening we heard him speak, he talked about the superconscious mind, and he described as the spiritual mind. He called the subconscious mind an imitator, which imprints and records all of our actions, thoughts, and experiences. He spoke nearly every night for many weeks, and in his words possessed an oratory of a kind to arouse the listener from spiritual slumber. For those who tended to regard his personality, he said, "Do not think of Yogananda, but of him who sent me." He also said, "Do not accept blindly what I say. Practice and prove for yourself from your own experience." These were prayer services, were included affirmations, the mental, physical, and spiritual well-being. Everybody participated in Swami's prayers, and powerful vibrations reinforced our own. After one of the meetings, I wrote, "I went to the healing service today, and at the last of the prayers, a wonderful wave came down and filled the room. It was a sensation like a blessing." Sunday services were and weekly lectures were not held, now held at Mount Washington headquarters. Mother and I attended regularly. In the summer of the 1920s, we were there to live and serve at the invitation of the resident teacher who had been placed in charge by Swami Yogananda. The building was scarcely occupied, and we had our choice of dozens of rooms, all unfurnished at the time. We chose a suite on the second floor and had it painted, then sent for our own furniture. Mother donated monthly sums to cover our food and living expenses. She received the visitors who came far and near and made them welcome until the teacher in charge could see them. Mother was a physician, and her voluntary service was possible because she had recently retired from medical practice. I found the stockroom needed attention and at once began by bringing order into the working steadily each day. I also worked in the office answering some of the letters of the Yogada students. On August 18th, we were happily busy at Mount Washington with preparation for Swami's arrival. The next afternoon, many students met him at the train and presented him with a beautiful bouquet of flowers. Mother and I were in the car with him as we rode back. He seemed immersed in God. Later, he said to us, "Cultivate God's friendship, meditate on Him, and feel Him. Be a stubborn child, and knock at that door until He opens it." In the evening, he visited with us for a while and said that he was very pleased that we were there. Swami brought fresh mangoes with him from the East Coast. The next night we had mango ice cream, which he planned as a surprise for everyone. He touched a blossom on the table and remarked, "In the flower, we capture the beauty of God." So I just wanted to read you a little bit of this to get a flavor of Kamala's time with Master. And she goes on to write many stories about him. But if you could imagine being in her shoes and what that was like to see Master on the stage for the first time. Mother talked about it, and she said that when Master came onto the stage, he looked like an angel. He's dressed in his orange robe. He had the long hair. And he was just beautiful. Now, he is also a human personality. And as you read details of different things, it was not always easy to be with him. We always can think in our minds just how wonderful it would be that the Master would receive us specially and think of us specially. But if he started to give us lessons and to see the things that we fall short upon and how that might be difficult. Roy Eugene Davis said when he first met Master that he wished he could report that Master said, "Oh, my beloved son, you have arrived here at last, and where have you been?" But instead he asked him how old he was, whether his parents knew that he was there, because he was very young-looking at the time. And so he allowed him to be able to stay. Each one has their stories, their own perspective. There were many who came to those classes, but few who stayed. Kamala had it within her soul to stay not just for a little while, but through the rest of her life she remained a loyal and avid student and disciple of Master's. We should look deep within ourselves. When we find that the well is running dry, it is not because there is not water at the bottom of the well when we are seeking it from God. Those living waters are infinite. There is no end to it. Master, in his own life, strove and did everything in his power to be able to contact God for himself first. And then through that contact with God to give it to everybody who he met. Now, he was truly a great engine for God. Sriyukteswar operated in a much more humble kind of a way. He just had a few students living with him. A couple of times a year, he had larger gatherings. But he never had the thousands that Master had knocking at his door. Mother had her own way of operating. Lari Mahasya operated even in a quieter way and did not advertise, did not do anything to promote himself, and those here and there came to see him and recognize the greatness of God within him. Each master comes in his own way. At one time, Papa told Mother, "Don't start an ashram, Mother. They're just a nest of troubles." And we are the great beneficiaries of these spiritual works that were started by Master and by Papa. And they're wonderful and they're beautiful. But for myself, I know that I have never aspired after large organization or buildings or properties. They're wonderful when you visit them, especially when you feel the spiritual vibrancy of a certain place, and we all benefit from those. But that ultimately, the laboratory of the soul is deep within us. And it doesn't make any difference where one or hundreds come, because God is infinite within each and every person. And when we seek him out genuinely and positively find him, moving from an unconscious life to a semi-conscious life to a conscious life to a super-conscious life, then we access the same God that inhabited Master, Mother, Papa, and all the great ones. Now, it doesn't mean that we've achieved their state of realization in a minute or in a day. They neither achieved theirs in a minute or a day. It was a process, and it all depends on where we begin at. These great masters all came into this lifetime with a very high state of realization. I know the state of consciousness that I came into this life with. And some of it was focused on God. I was going, reviewing over things in my life recently, as the first of the year is apt to do. And I was thinking back in those early days when I used to sit in my room and the sound of silence was so loud that it would hurt my ears and it would hurt my head, the vibration of Om, and I didn't have anyone to teach me about it, to know what it was that it was occurring. For some reason, I never thought to ask anybody about it, but I know there wasn't anybody who would have had an adequate answer at the time. I knew it was coming from some higher source. It wasn't a problem with my ears that the doctor could fix. But this was powerful, and it was uplifting. But I also wasn't able to incorporate it. I came with insecurities. I was remembering when I first took up wrestling, and I get so nervous before a wrestling match that I'd want to throw up. And my coach wasn't very good at reading my personality. And I remember when I was going to wrestle one particular kid, and he was walking by, and he said, "Well, the other fellow's coach tells me this is the strongest kid that he's ever seen." Well, I think he was trying to inspire me in some way. He's just inspiring me to seek out the door to run away. He completely misread me. Somebody else, it may wake them up. It may take them out of complacency. I was not complacent. I didn't come with that sense of will and to go over everything as Master had done, as Mother had done. So I had a long ways to come. And yet when I met Mother, I recognized within her the power of God within her. And I responded to it, and I stuck with it. And I was sincere in my practice. The other day, somebody was asking me what I thought about a certain individual, and I said, "Well, I think that they're sincere." "Oh, well," to them that seemed like a throwaway sentence, but it's not. I know there are spiritual teachers who have risen to great fame, who have published many books, and I would not describe them as sincere. That is a high compliment in my book, when somebody is sincere. It means that they apply themselves, and if they make a mistake, then they rectify it where they can, and they get right back on board again. This is absolutely essential, and there are those out of pride who will not admit that they made a mistake. They just go on, and they try to ignore what they did. And then they repeat it again, and then they repeat it again. This is not a sincere aspirant. This is somebody who has lost their way. And as I say, they may publish books. They may do all kinds of things that to all the world may appear spiritual, but they're not. We have to be sincere in our practice. That is first and foremost. Now, we all make mistakes in our upward journey to God. So just because somebody makes a mistake doesn't mean we should write them off. Not at all. When that individual turns about to the light, sometimes they'll zoom past other people who have remained steadfast but are more lukewarm. That individual who's taken a fall realizes how bad it can get. And as a result of that, they have more determined practice, more aspiration, more purity of purpose than ever before. So it is not just whether we do everything perfectly from the beginning. That's unlikely. But when we do make a mistake, that we change course quickly and powerfully and with a strong determination never to turn away from God ever again. So let us emulate Master. He is such a great example for us. Came with such an aspiration for God. Such a determination to know God. And whether he made mistakes on the way up, I know not. I only know that he remained true to God and Guru. And that as a result of that, the great blessings that poured from him, not just to Kamala, but to Mother. And when Mother reflected on it, she knew everything that God had given to her through her Master. So she knew the greatness of God within him. This is the real sign of a realized master, is that capacity to lift us into the highest realms of God. But we have to be willing to do our part. If we are not true, if we are not sincere, if we are not putting our shoulder to the wheel, we cannot expect God just to do it for us. If we are not doing our part, it is we as individual souls who have closed the door to God. We must open that door. God is knocking, but who is receiving? And that is the great question. That is our part. Because when we open that door and we receive, God will come to us in all of his greatness, in all of his power, in all of his glory, and we will not mistake in it for any other experience. Now, sometimes, on a personal basis, I would like to be able to respond more to individuals. But God will take me up for days and sometimes weeks at a time. And I easily commune with everyone on an interior basis, but not so easily on an exterior basis. And this is the nature of the work God chooses to do through this form at this time. It is not that I don't want to. Sometimes it is just not his will. And if there are times when I try to do something because I think that I should, and it is not God's will, he makes it abundantly clear to me that it is not mine to do, and I must surrender to him in that moment, as we all must surrender to the infinite. But that any time anybody comes to my mind, I instantly feel my connection with that one. And not just mine in a personal sense, but I feel God flowing through this form. And I feel it going out to that individual or that group or that situation. And it's wonderful when God uses you in this way. So let us be sincere in our practice. Let us follow Master and the Great Ones. Whatever your individuality, how it suits God to use you. Do not dictate to Him, but rather surrender to Him. Find out what it is that God has chosen to do through you, and then fulfill that. And if that means working at it until your last breath, Christine, who left the body not long ago, I had given her instructions, and I told her, I said, think on perfect health. And even if it is your last breath, and you're thinking of perfect health, that is what you take with you. And you will never have to go through these experiences again, because what you take with you is what is in your mind. And she kept that, and she had other people, well, you have to be realistic now. You have to think about that it's the end of your life, and that you're not going to recover, and she refused it all. She kept with it. She kept thinking of perfect health right up until that last breath. And as a result of that, she released herself from all previous samskaras and karma because she had freed herself of fear and of limitation. And she thought only of God, Guru, and perfect health. Now, if we can all do that, think of the perfection of God within you, no matter how things are manifesting now. If things are materially difficult, think of God manifesting perfectly already inside of you as that material prosperity. If it is a health issue, remain focused. This doesn't mean that you can't seek out help from a doctor or change your habits to healthier habits. It just means simply that perfect health already exists inside of you. Perfect consciousness already exists inside of you. And as you hold that, you hold the door open for that to manifest in you. And you don't retain any charge of the past samskara, the past karma, that would keep you imprisoned in an old habit. You can free yourself of everything of the past and find God dwelling inside of you. This is a great thing, a great thing, a great shortcut. You don't have to think of yourself as attaining perfection in a human kind of a way. Rather, perfection already exists inside of you. You need only let it manifest inside. Remove those limiting thoughts and factors that keep you bound and imprisoned. So no matter what your life looks like, enlightened or not enlightened, healthy or not healthy, prosperous or not prosperous, know that God is perfect already within you and that He can change your circumstances in a flash if He wishes to. Or He can hold you in certain circumstances, perhaps to make you stronger in spirit, perhaps to test your love and your loyalty for Him alone, but that you have that in you already. So let us enter into superconscious living and keep it with us always. Now will you pray with me? O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee.
and surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Ooh.